Welcome to the ninth and final episode of Runaway Joe.
I saw Joe Maloney as a Jekyll and Hyde character. His personality could flip in a moment.
Throughout this series, we've continued to receive tips and insights from listeners who encountered Joe Maloney during his time in Ireland.
He loved Tabasco sauce and used to drink it by the mug with boiling water.
When an official came to disconnect the electricity supply because of unpaid bills, Joe Maloney shot at him twice.
And as we near the end of our story, we're including as many of these tips as we can.
Maloney had friends in high places. Big cars with blacked out windows would arrive down to Cappard. These were either high-ranking bank officials or politicians or both.
Maloney was rumoured to have IRA connections.
And the darkness that he might have tried to leave behind him in the US, that came with him. Behind it all, Joe Maloney remained the same man, despite the name change.
When a debt collector came to Cappard, he was punched unconscious by Joe. When a revenue inspector came, Joe beat him up and threatened to kill him.
After Maloney seriously sexually assaulted a woman, allegedly, female staff working at Cappard were warned to never be on their own with him.
Joe was part of a gang of thieves. Four men. They'd leave Cappard at dusk and not return until 3 or 4 a.m. They stole the bell from a local church, as well as the church gates. Nothing was sacrosanct.
I'm Pavel Barter. From RTE Documentary on One, this is Runaway Joe. Episode 9, Within Sight. Far away from Cappard Estate in the Midlands of Ireland, myself and my co-producer Tim have come to Northern Cyprus in search of Joe Maloney and his wife Sheila, as we believe this is where they came to live after 1990. 20 years ago, Michael Nage, the writer on a one-man mission to try and track down Joe Maloney, also made this journey. Before he came here, he penned two identical letters and gave one to Rod Fenning, the man who helped Maloney escape Ireland, and another to Sheila's family in Dublin.
Explaining that I would be in North Cyprus in 2 weeks' time and would be happy to meet Michael and Sheila for lunch in the Arzi's restaurant close to the harbour in Kyrenia.
Michael Nage's letter detailed two potential meetups with a time, date and place to meet. And of course, he was hoping that the contents of these letters would be communicated through to Joe and Sheila.
I'm in Kyrenia outside Niazi's restaurant. Niazi's was the place where Michael Nage arranged to meet Joe and Sheila.
It was a hotter day than usual when I walked down the quiet streets to Niazi's an hour before the appointment. I chose to sit at a cafe opposite. I drank a coffee and then another. I scarcely paid any attention to a woman who stopped by a parked car and turned to take a good look inside the restaurant before walking on.
This woman was almost gone before Michael Nage took notice. He had an indication of what to look out for from Erica Lotz, the German housekeeper at Cappard House.
Sheila now has a tumour on her head which they can't afford to treat, so she wears a wig to disguise it.
By now, Sheila had been living with breast cancer for almost 10 years, so the description made sense. That day came and went. The second meeting was at the same location 4 days later.
I decided to stand outside Niazi so there could be no mistaking my arrival. Almost an hour had gone by when, from round the corner, came the same rather peculiar-looking lady who'd passed by before. From about 15 yards away, she fished a mobile phone out of her handbag. "He's here," she said, loud enough for me to hear, before walking straight by me, speaking Turkish. Dark glasses covered her face, her head covered by a wig. A wig? It had to be. "Sheila," I cried out, but she carried on walking, quickening her pace. Instead of hurrying after her, I watched her till she disappeared.
That encounter appears to confirm that in 2003, Sheila Chandler and her husband Joe were here. In 2003, the same year Michael Nage was in Northern Cyprus, the BBC broadcast a programme presented by undercover reporter Paul Kenyon called Fugitives Paradise.
This is a country which doesn't officially exist. It was created after an invasion which broke international law. That means no extradition treaty. Wanted criminals can live here freely. They won't be sent home.
2024. And now we're in Northern Cyprus, trying to find further evidence that Joe Maloney and his wife escaped here. Someone who knows this place well is Denise Phillips, who works for the national broadcaster. Why would Joe Maloney have come here?
Well, he could disappear here. He could live fairly off-grid here. I've got a feeling he was living on a boat.
Would it have been possible for him to live a very quiet existence here, to buy a little house, maybe in the countryside?
Yeah, a definite possibility. You know, there's a lot of little mountain villages, but there's a good expat population from all different countries living up in Carmi, a little village up there where they live, not off-grid, but they have one or two little pubs up there.
We're driving up through the hills towards the village of Carmi in North Cyprus with Julian Maudsley, who spent 30 years of his career as a police officer before retiring.
And I came out here in 93 for a holiday. Absolutely fell in love with the place and the people.
Julian is also the chair of the British Residence Society in Northern Cyprus.
A lot of people come out here and reinvent themselves. And you get people coming in and they tell you a lifelong story of how they were a hero in the war, or they were their top generals, or a nice story that they think their next-door neighbours would appreciate.
The banking and legal systems in Northern Cyprus aren't fully connected to the rest of the world, and there are no direct flights to any country other than Turkey. It's a territory that's basically off-grid.
It's a good place for people who want to disappear under the radar.
That's Barry, another ex-cop from England.
And the police don't ask too many questions. So although there are rules and regulations, if you have a bit of money and you know the right people, you can disappear. And as long as you behave yourself, it's fine. Just keep your nose clean. Nobody bothers.
We've brought photographs of Joe Maloney with us to Northern Cyprus, and the British expat community is asking around to see if anyone recognises him.
Hey, I just sent you a picture. Can you have a look at that? Did he ever live in Cyprus, that guy? Can you have a look at it?
We know that Joe and Sheila could both speak German, so we're going to meet some of the German expat community who live in North Cyprus to look for information.
This is his phone number, WhatsApp address. His wife is Rika.
Oh, his wife is Rika, yeah.
So I spoke with him, and if you call him, you can ask him.
They recommend we speak to a German couple, Rika and her husband Andreas, who've been living here since 1984.
Yes. Would you like to have a cup of tea? It's cold tea with ginger and lemon.
That would be lovely.
I would.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Master Malik, I'm the bit.
Yeah.
Sit down wherever you like to sit. Tim hat dein Tee und Pavel hat sein Tee hier. Und ich hab meinen Tee hier.
Danke schön, Rika.
We show them some pictures of Joe Maloney.
That is from the 80s, I think.
Ah.
Hast du das gleiche?
No.
Yeah.
I don't say anything. Let just Andy look at him. There's one picture.
Yeah, here on links, no?
Yes, and that man I might have seen, just seen. Yeah. Never spoke to him.
That one.
Yeah, same. He shows to the same.
Both Rika and Andreas recognize Joe from the same picture.
Maybe in harbour having a brandy sour.
Meeting point.
That might be or some restaurant.
Meeting point was
in that town we met in the harbour.
Harbour.
In Kyrenia?
Yeah, Kyrenia
yes.
Harbour. I just have seen that face, that's it.
Me too.
Nothing more. And we showed to the same picture, both of us.
Well, it's fascinating that you recognise the face.
Both of us. I told you, I will not tell him. And he showed the same picture.
And Andreas's reaction was, I know him.
Yes, like me. Like me. Huh? There's only one. And I gave the pictures to Andreas without saying which one.
It's kind of thrilling that despite being on the trail of an alleged murderer, we know we're in the right place. Rika and Andreas connect me with another German woman, Yasmin, from the German embassy in Cyprus, and she instantly recognizes Joe Maloney from our photos.
Okay. He was sitting in the harbor many times when we were there as well, and especially the ice I can remember very good.
Yasmin saw Maloney in the 1990s at the harbour in Kyrenia, here in northern Cyprus, not far from where Michael Nage said he encountered Sheila.
Because in the 90s, the harbour was always very empty and not a lot of people were sitting there. And in this time, you were always able to remember all people you have seen there a few times. I remember that we talked about him even, that he looks like a man who is going to the sea.
His face stood out to you.
Yes, and I remember the eyes especially. I think he was sitting alone, and this was the reason why I recognize him. On this time, a lot of people were living on boats. It could be that he was living on a boat, yeah? He was, I don't know, he was strange for me.
But you're positive?
Yes, I'm positive.
Michael Nage only had that one encounter with Sheila in northern Cyprus, and he never laid eyes on Joe. He returned to Ireland, and in 2006, he tragically drowned while attempting to swim to an island off the Galway coast. He never did get to write Joe Maloney's biography, but he did send all his discoveries to the friends of June, the woman Joe allegedly killed, and his work played a critical role in our search for Joe and Sheila. It's what led us to northern Cyprus. But it's time for Tim and I to leave this place and return home now. We're encouraged by the numerous positive sightings of Joe Maloney, but now this story was beginning to overtake us. Things were about to happen that we could never have imagined.
From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made at a party. In 1967, a Rochester couple was throwing their son a party for his fifth birthday.
After this series began publishing, Runaway Joe received press attention in Joe Maloney's hometown of Rochester, New York. Gary Craig wrote a front-page article for the Rochester Democrat and Chronicle. And the following day, the local NPR radio station, WXXI, also had us on to talk about this series.
This was the beginning of what would become a decades-long murder investigation, a case that has still not officially been solved or closed. That's because Joseph...
What we didn't know then was someone very close to this story was following all of this and our series. I'm on my way to meet another Joe Maloney, who lives more than 10,000 kilometers away from Cyprus.
Drop off Pavel on the right.
Okay, thank you.
Good work.
Push.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
You must be Pavel.
You must be Joe.
I am.
Nice to meet you, sir.
Welcome to our home.
Thank you.
Wow. Come on in.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Joe. You guys know me as Joe Maloney. I am Joey Jr.
This Joe, named after his father, is the son of Joe Maloney and June Fisk. Joey Jr. hasn't had any contact with his parents since 1967, when his mother was killed and his father went on the run. Joe reached out to us a few weeks ago, and it's hard to believe I'm here at his home in Florida speaking to him. In my mind, Joey has always been the five-year-old left orphaned after his mother June was killed and his father Joe abandoned him. But before me is a 61-year-old man who, yes, bears a resemblance to his father. Joey was born on May the 28th, 1962. He only has a few early childhood memories of his time with his mother June and father Joe.
they are memories in my mind. They're vivid. I know the house. I know the yard. I had a tree swing in the front yard. The tree swing came back and hit me. That's how I lost my front teeth at such a young age. I remember the people, but not their faces. I remember my dog's name was Barry.
Joey has fleeting memories of his mother, June.
I remember going grocery shopping with her, stopping at the store with her. She drove a olive green Chevy Corvair with a white convertible roof.
Do you have a visual memory of her?
Not really. Not until I saw the picture. I have not seen pictures of her in 50 years.
And memories of his father, Joe?
Joe drove a bright reddish-orange Ford Mustang. I remember going for a ride in that. He built me the tree swing in the yard. He spent a lot of time down in the basement. You know, I wasn't supposed to go down in the basement, but once in a while went down there, and he had a box. We opened the box, and there was a severed hand in the box. It was, just like somebody's hand. I'm sure it was a prop, but it was kind of shocking.
Was he strict?
Strict, yeah. I only remember being disciplined maybe two times. You know, but no, he was never violent towards me. It was just, you know, knock it off, or I told you not to, or whatever.
In 1965, when Joey turned three, his sister Patricia Ann, or Patty Ann, as everyone called her, was born.
I mean, she was a baby sister. I just vaguely remember the day she came home from the hospital. I mean, she just looked like a little doll in the baby carrier.
Patty Ann was a baby when her mother June was killed and her father Joe went on the run. She has no memories of that time, and this series has filled in a lot of those blanks. But Joe, he does have solid memories of his parents, including of them arguing, mostly over religion.
Joe was a strict Catholic. I believe the church that he took us to was St. Anne's, and she was a Protestant. I don't know what the church was, but they argued continuously about what church we were going to. She would, air quotes, sneak us to the Protestant church. And yeah, he did not like that at all.
We know from police statements that shortly before Joe Maloney allegedly killed June, he travelled to Ireland and left June and their children, Joey Jr. and Patty Ann, with no money.
You know, shortly before my birthday in 67, he had been to Ireland maybe in the spring. And I do remember my mother, June, and I, we went back to the house on Eastmoreland. And I think she was looking for money. She was upstairs. She was in the bedroom. I think she had stashed some money. She was digging through everything and she couldn't find it. And she just sat down and started crying.
By the time Joey's fifth birthday party came around, June had left her husband, moved out of the family home, and was living in an apartment with her children, Joey and Patty Ann. Joe Maloney had remained in their family home, which he chose as the location for Joey's fifth birthday party, which Joey remembers.
There were a lot of people at the house, and I got lots of birthday presents. That's about all I know. It was just a fun birthday for me.
What I hear next is incredibly tragic. Immediately after the party, June appears to have known she'd been poisoned. Remember, she'd endured years of coercive control from her ex-husband Joe and was by now really afraid of him. Even 5-year-old Joey knew there was something wrong with his mother as they returned home to the apartment.
I remember she just pulled her car off the road and started crying. And she just sat there and cried for a while. And then, you know, after, let's say, 5, maybe 10 minutes, we just drove to the apartment.
It wasn't long after that that June began to get really ill and was taken to hospital, where she fell into a coma.
I just know that I was told she was sick and had to go to the hospital. And I can't remember who told me she had passed away.
Joey and Patty Ann were staying with their mother's friend Wanda throughout all that time. but that was about to change when social services removed them from Wanda's care.
Joey locked himself in the bathroom. Here's this 5-year-old kid, and he says, "Wanda, please don't let him take me. Please don't let him take me." And I had to let him take him. I couldn't keep him.
Yes, I remember it well. That's when I didn't want to go. The first night in my foster house, I just said I wanted to go home. I don't want to be here. So it was an adjustment.
Joey and his sister, Patty Ann, were initially placed together in a foster family, and they were partially in hiding when their father, Joe, escaped from custody and went on the run.
We were kind of in a self-imposed witness protection program. We weren't really supposed to tell our story, just because who knows, you know, Joe was out there, you know. We were just kind of always looking over our shoulder.
Joey and Patty Ann's foster family lived in the wider Rochester area, and this family went on to adopt them both, giving them a happy and stable childhood. But they rarely spoke about June or Joe with their new adoptive children.
Once in a while, you know, we'd talk about it. You know, my mother, she'd say, you know, he's believed to be in Ireland. But it was almost like a past life. It wasn't talked about a lot. You know, if it wasn't a big deal at the time.
When news of their father's arrest blew up the media in 1985, Joe and Patty Ann were by now young adults.
You know, Rochester's a small city, and this was a big event. So for that 3 days, this was all over the news. It was just a non-event for me. But yeah, I do remember that, the treaty breakdown, and he wouldn't be coming back to the United States.
But it wasn't something that you lost any sleep over?
No, not at all.
Joe Maloney was largely forgotten by his son until 1991, when his story was reenacted on the TV show Unsolved Mysteries.
My wife and I were watching it, and at the end, they always did a teaser, and they said, next week, we have the story of a man who poisoned his wife and fled the country.
June arrived at Joe's house for their son's 5th birthday party. Joe offered June a drink, and she stayed at the party for 2 hours.
Here you are.
Oh, thank you.
You know, Joey told me this was his best birthday party ever. Okay.
Unsolved Mysteries came on, and they showed the upcoming episode of the little redheaded boy with the balloons.
That's Joey's wife, Donna.
And he looks at me and goes, "That's me. We need to talk."
And why had you kept the story to yourself?
It was just something I never really talked about. I don't know, maybe just we grew up with the stigma attached. I just never advertised it.
Did Joe ever try and contact you?
No, not at all.
A year before the first episode of Runaway Joe, when I found Karen, Joe Maloney's first daughter from his first marriage, I asked Karen if she'd consider uploading her DNA to Ancestry.com to help in our search for her father. Some months later, she called us back with surprising news.
I found one brother, and he told me about another brother. One brother was born on Joey's birthday, the one I talked to, and the other one was either born 2 weeks before or 2 weeks after that. So they're both the same age.
Although Karen found no trace of her father when she uploaded her DNA to Ancestry, she did find two new siblings, two boys, born to two different mothers in the same month of the same year. So these must have been affairs, I guess, that Joe Maloney was having.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was. While June was pregnant with Patty, because she was born in October.
65.
These boys were born in 65. They were born in May in different hospitals.
So, in the same year, Joe Maloney had three different children born to three different mothers, including his wife, June Fisk. From that point on, we knew Joe Maloney had fathered at least six children: Karen and her sister from his first marriage to Joan Howland, Joey and Patty Ann from his second marriage to June Fisk, and two more boys with two more women he'd had affairs with while married to June. This was one of the first things I had to tell Joe in my initial telephone conversation with him some weeks back.
Joe, we found out some more information which could, you know, maybe change things even more for you. Are you sitting down?
I am now.
Okay. Basically, yourself and Patty have four half siblings that you may not have known about.
No, we did not.
These six siblings, some of whom have only just found out about each other, are now all aged in their late 50s and 60s. They're starting a new stage in life, finding each other and a new family. Getting some sense of justice for Joey's mother, June Fisk, is the main reason why we're telling this story. Last year, when we were in Rochester, we visited June's grave, together with her niece, Amy Emmerich.
This is Lakeview Cemetery. And it's fortunate that we don't have a lot of snow on the ground, because they do close this if the snow gets too deep and you can't drive through. Yes, here we are. That's June's mom. And so June is here with my grandfather. It's very peaceful up here.
Yeah.
It's very nice up here.
We pay our respects to June. The inscription on her Fisk family headstone says, "Daughter June Maloney, 1940 to 1967. She was just 26 years old when Joe Maloney is alleged to have ended her life.
It's very difficult because I never got to meet her. So in a way, I'm not missing someone I knew. It's a little different.
It's a different type of loss.
It is.
But it is a loss.
Yes, yes.
And the other loss, of course, was that she had two children.
Yes.
Two children who may not even know that she even existed.
Exactly. Exactly.
And that's tragic.
Yes.
Well, hopefully we can set that straight anyway, at least that part.
Listening back to those recordings now, we didn't know there were six children. I still can't believe we've inadvertently pieced these siblings and their extended families back together. Back to the present day. It's about a week since we put Amy, June's niece, in touch with her first cousin Joey for the very first time.
And I called her out of the blue and
the person on the other end of the line said, "Is this Amy? Is this Amy?" I'm like, "Yes." I said, "Who is this?" And he said, "Are you sitting down?" I'm like, "Who is this?" He goes, "It's your cousin, Joey."
She sat silent for a little while, and I stuttered when I talked to her. But, you know, we had a pleasant conversation for 10 or 15 minutes. And
since then, we stay in touch every week. And we're sharing photos, you know, of our families. So it's been an amazing experience. And Joe and I are looking forward to continue to get to know each other.
As we near the end of our series, I call Wendy Lehman, the retired prosecutor at the DA's office in Rochester, who works so hard in trying to return Joe Maloney to the US to face trial for June's murder. Wendy's been listening to the series since it began.
You've uncovered a lot of things that I certainly wasn't aware of at the time or since. I was realizing when I was working on it, I was working on the extradition. That's what I was doing. And, you know, I was focused on that. And I really didn't know too much. So that's just been, from a personal point of view, fascinating to fill in all those blank corners that I didn't have before. Well, I think in terms of bringing justice to June, and now really we know all the other people he probably hurt too. you know, the fact that that you have worked so hard to uncover the, what the truth was, that does bring a certain amount of justice to those people, that somebody cared this far out to still try and find out what the truth was and what, if anything, could be done to further justice. And, you know, justice can come in many different forms, and sometimes the courts aren't the best. Sometimes it's people. I think maybe all that could be done has been done by you.
This series has helped uncover some truths that got buried over time, including for Joey Jr. about his father.
Up until the series, I thought maybe the murder was an argument or a crime of passion or something, but now it turns out he was just a bad man.
Joe has more calls and connections to make with his newfound siblings, but one call that can't wait is Wanda, June's friend who cared for Joe and his sister Patty Ann after their mother was poisoned. 57 years on, Joey still remembers his last glimpse of Wanda from when he was a five-year-old boy.
You know, I last saw Wanda when I got in the car and drove away, and then never heard from her again. I just wanted to let Wanda know that we're fine.
Joey and I called Wanda, and they spoke for the first time since 1967.
Oh my goodness, I just can't believe it. I've wondered about you and Patty for so long.
Well, we're fine. We did well.
I'm so happy.
As the conversation goes on, Wanda wants to tell Joey all about his mother, June.
Your mom, she was super. She was just a great person. She was very kind. She was bubbly. She had a smile on her face most of the time. She was never down. I don't ever remember her yelling at you guys or telling you to sit down, or she just went with the flow, you know? She was just, and she loved you guys so much. Are you married?
Yes.
Do you have children?
I'm married. I've got two sons, 33 and 31, and now I have two grandchildren, a three-year-old, and I'm going to say she's like a 18 or 19-month-old a granddaughter.
I have two children. Actually, I would have had four if I had adopted you and Patty.
This is the first time that Joey has found out that Wanda wanted to become both his and Patty Ann's adoptive mother.
And I wanted to adopt you and Patty because I wanted you to stay with me. And I think your mom would have wanted that.
A local caseworker told her this wouldn't have been in the best interest of the kids.
He said it would be best if I didn't adopt you, because for the fact that, you know, you'd always be reminded of what happened to your mom. But I broke my heart. I cried for days. I'm sure your mom's smiling down on you.
Yes.
You and your sister. I know she's very happy.
I would like to think so.
I feel that she's very happy that you guys are okay.
Joe Maloney is the common thread throughout this story. And in our search for justice for June, he's also the man we've tried so hard to find. We thought we'd found out everything we could about Joe Maloney, that we got to the end of the line. But then, just 3 days before this episode was published, this happens.
Sheila was very, very careful.
This is part of a conversation I've just had with a family member of Sheila's, Joe Maloney's wife. Because of the sensitivities involved, my colleague Nicolene is helping me go through what they told us.
They never had an inkling that Joe and Sheila had gone to East Germany.
We know that in the late 1990s, Sheila began to return home to Dublin for cancer treatment.
Sheila was a very private person, and her family learned that she would close up if they asked her questions. So her attitude was that they were just better off not knowing. She never opened up and she never gave anything away. she always referred to Joe Maloney as Michael when she was at home.
By not telling her family anything, Sheila never put them at risk from withholding information from the authorities.
And even to this day, they don't know if Sheila believed or didn't believe that Joe killed June Fisk. And while Sheila wasn't someone who suffered fools, she was definitely loyal to her husband Joe in spite of all that had happened.
Sheila also gave some rare glimpses into life on the run.
They lived a very simple life. They ate very healthily. Sheila was physically strong. They grew their own vegetables. They seemed largely self-sufficient. Sheila was a great cook and Joe wasn't. They did confirm that Sheila never had any children with Joe Maloney.
And then they begin to tell us what we've been looking for.
Sheila used to occasionally ring from wherever she was. And at one stage, she said that Joe Maloney was not well. But she didn't give any other details about what was wrong with him.
Rod Fenning, who'd helped Joe and Sheila escape, Rod told his partner that Joe Maloney got Alzheimer's around this time.
You know, I do remember he did say to me that Michael O'Shea had Alzheimer's and therefore he wouldn't be able to be held responsible for any crime he's supposed to have committed. Well, I would say it was 2000 and something, you know. How he knew, I didn't ask.
Rod died a few years ago, but curiously, one of the things Rod's partner found in his belongings after his death was an amount of Cypriot coins, the most recent of which dated from 2005. That was around the same time that Sheila's family heard the next piece of information around Joe Maloney from Sheila. The final piece of information about Joe Maloney.
One day, Sheila rang them up and she told them that Joe Maloney was dead. It was sometime around 2004, 05 or 2006 that they said Joe had died. And they can't give a location of where he was either buried or cremated because they were never told. All Sheila told them is that Joe Maloney had died. And then shortly after his death, Sheila moved permanently back to Dublin.
That conversation floored me. For 18 months now, we've been trying to find out what happened to Joe Maloney. And right now, right here, at the very end of this journey, 9 episodes in, it appears we've done just that. I'm keen to relay Sheila's story about Joe Maloney's death to people who've lived with this for their whole lives.
So he passed away before she went home to Ireland?
That's what we've been told, yeah, in the mid-2000s. Amy, June Fisk's niece.
Did they give any other details?
Nope, no other details.
In all likelihood, yes, he has passed away, but I want to know what the end of his life was like.
Yeah.
Because the way he took my Aunt June and the suffering, even the suffering she endured before he poisoned her, and then the suffering that she went through for 2 weeks, I guess I would like more details. I think for all of us, we need hard proof versus their word.
Yeah. And when I tell Joey that Sheila said his father was dead, does that surprise you, or what are your thoughts about it?
No, it doesn't surprise me at all, Pavel. From what I remember from the early newspaper articles in the 80s, that when he was first apprehended in Ireland, that he was showing his age then from years of heavy drinking. So I'm not surprised. I think time probably caught up with him.
June's friend Wanda. Just like June's niece, Amy, Wanda can't give up hope that Joe Maloney might one day face justice.
I think he's still alive. I thought, maybe he's gone, but I just don't feel it. I just don't. Maybe it's because I want him to pay for what he did.
Yeah.
I don't want him to get away with everything scot-free. I want proof that that's it. Closed book. He
ruined his family. I want to see him pay. Hopefully, maybe he is dead.
When Joe's wife Sheila returned home to Dublin in 2006, her cancer had progressed to stage 4, a terminal diagnosis. Even in the final months of her life, she continued to protect her husband.
Even to the extent that any photographs and things that Sheila had, her family told us that she destroyed everything before she died. She was always very, very careful.
Despite Sheila's efforts to cover up their tracks, rumours of Joe's death soon spread back in the area of Coppard House, where he once lived in the Midlands of Ireland.
You know, I just heard he died, so, you know, I just accepted it.
Peter Collins, Joe's former neighbour at Coppard.
I was in Cyprus, you know, a few years ago, and I was sort of thinking it'd be a good idea to sort of try and find him, because he's a fairly visible person, you know, if he's around. But he was untouched there, and I believe he died there.
Erica Lotz, the German caretaker at Coppard House, also talked openly about Joe's death. Sean Wisely, who worked for Joe, or Michael O'Shea, as he knew him at Coppard, recalls one such encounter.
I met her in Mount Melick one day. She said, "Your old friend died," but I didn't know who she was talking about, you know. And I said, "Who? Who was my friend that died?" "Michael O'Shea," she said. I didn't hear any more about it then after that, like, you know.
Sheila Chandler died in 2010, aged 65. Her death certificate read, "Married, but separated." There was no public announcement. Her remains were cremated. For Joe Maloney's firstborn child, Karen, she's waited her whole life to hear what happened to her dad. He died around that time. It would have been 2004, 2005, 2006. And Sheila then came back to Ireland permanently shortly after that.
What did he die of?
We don't know, but there were some reports that he had Alzheimer's.
I'm in shock, and yet there's the closure, you know, that I guess we needed, you know. I'm sorry, I kind of have a pain in my chest, but just no hearing that. But it's closure. He's gone, you know. Your story's ended, and you found Joey. You know, that is a big deal for me, because I don't know. I can't explain it. I want to cry, because it's okay. It's okay. It's over. It's done. It's, you know, and I'll be okay. I'll be okay.
Oh.
I appreciate you calling. Is this the last?
The very last call I make is to Wendy Lehman, the retired DA in Rochester.
Hello?
Hi, Wendy. It's Pavel speaking here.
Oh, hi, Pavel.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good. Sorry to bother you. I was just giving a quick call, something you might be of interest.
Given everything Wendy knows about this case, what does she think about the final part of this jigsaw around our fugitive? Of Sheila telling her family that Joe Maloney died around 2005.
Do you think it's a significant bit of information?
Oh, I think it certainly is, yeah. I mean, it does certainly put another check in that box, isn't it? And a significant one. You've put so much into this. It'd be nice to have some more sense of closure, although I think this is pretty definitive closure.
This is the end of our series of Runaway Joe. And just like retired District Attorney Wendy Lehman, we also believe this brings pretty definitive closure. And while this marks the end of Joe's story, it also heralds the beginning of something new. 57 years after Joe Maloney destroyed a family, that family are now reuniting, turning away from the past and looking toward the future.
I had no idea, you know, that you could ever find them, because they were put away into the system, you know, to protect them. No idea.
here they are.
Karen?
Yes.
I've talked to people, you, Amy, Wanda, that I have not talked to in 54 years. It's just kind of an incredible experience.
You know, what a story. What a story.